Hello, everyone. This episode of the podcast is about birth and the birthing process. This is something that most people seem to think they don't need to know anything about until it's about to happen. And you read a book or you watch a quick video and go to a quick class and you get it sorted out. And that's what I thought. And I have been enlightened. There is a lot to know about the way that birth is done in this country, in Canada, and in the Western world that should be questioned. Let's just say there's lots to learn. And this episode is very enlightening. And whether you're a man or a woman, I recommend you listen to this. If you're a man and you don't plan to give birth, just know that you will probably be supporting someone who's giving birth at some point in your life. And the stuff that was shared on this episode is stuff that you need to know. So an hour well spent for sure. Before we get into the episode, a word about a sponsor. This is my first sponsor ever. Northern Saunas is the sponsor. And we got a sauna from these guys. We got this like 5-person outdoor sauna, and it is, I think it's called the Clear Light Outdoor Sanctuary, the 5-person sauna. It's the most badass sauna I've ever been in. And we just sprung for it, and it's been a game changer. It's infrared sauna, but it's a new type of infrared sauna. The traditional kind that you may remember looks like it has like these oven rods that direct heat at your body, but there's a new kind that has these ceramic panels, and it's called far infrared technology. So it's further down the spectrum, and I don't really know what this means, but it's a lower EMF. So there's like less of an electromagnetic frequency that's kind of like disruptive. And apparently it's healthier. I don't really know anything about that stuff, but everybody's saying that the low EMF stuff is better than the traditional infrared sauna. So this is low EMF, and then it has these like heaters on the front that crank out some real heat for obvious reasons because it's cold outside. But check out Northern Saunas if you're interested in a sauna. We put this thing together in 2 hours, me and 3 other guys, and we really didn't even need the 2 other guys for most of the time. We just needed them to put the lid on. It didn't even, there was not one screw. Like, everything just went together so perfectly. It like snapped together like Lego, and bam, we had a sauna in our backyard. We had to get the wires set up, get the electrical set up, but overall, what a crazy simple setup compared to building your own sauna, which I've seen done, and it's quite the project. These guys have all different kinds of saunas. We were actually considering putting one in my office, a smaller one, and in the end, we sprung for the big one outside. But saunaing has been a game changer in my life, and it takes me to this place where I usually I like to stay in the sauna for a stupid amount of time and like really push myself so that I'm like almost panicking, and then jump out and get into some cold water. But after that, there's this like peacefulness that washes over me. And it's like, I long for that feeling because it's just so, quiet and euphoric. So, yeah, check out Northern Saunas. And, there's like a little piece on my Instagram about it too. And, I think they have a holiday sale on right now. So that's it. Check out Northern Saunas. Okay, back to the episode. Jessica Austin is an authority. I really enjoyed talking to her, and she is, she has a lot of opinions, and her opinions are based on science. And I really like that because this conversation is going to be triggering for some people. We're going to talk about things that, that may trigger other people, either because you've been through a birthing experience that didn't go well, or because you have strong opinions about how things should be done. But all of Jessica's statements are based on science. So there's a lot to learn here, folks. And I really encourage you to share this episode with your friends when you know that they're expecting early. Share it early with them, not right before they give birth, because there's a planning process. This stuff is good to know before you start planning to give birth. So check it out, enjoy the episode, share it with your friends, subscribe, leave a review, and thanks everyone for supporting the podcast. I really enjoy doing this and having conversations like this with people like Jessica, and I like to float around on the subject territory and dabble in a number of different things. So thanks for coming with me on that ride as well, and I hope everyone is enjoying the holiday season. Lots of love.
Inspiring conversations for the modern man. The Evolving Man Podcast.
Okay, let's do this. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Evolving Man Podcast. My name is Ben Goreski, and I am here with two guests, my lovely wife, Shalina, and our friend, Jessica Austin, who runs Jessica. You're on Instagram, you're Jessica Austin Childbirth, and your business is called Birth Takes a Village. Jessica, I will let you intro yourself, but we're talking about, just so everybody knows what we're talking about on this episode, we're talking about birth. And before you press pause and move on to a new episode because you think that there's nothing to learn about birth, let me school you for a moment. Since meeting Shalina, actually, 4 years ago, I have been schooled, and I have found out that much of what I knew about birth and the whole process was, basically just passed down to me through my culture. And I was very misunderstood about what the dangers of birth were, what tends to go right, what tends to not go right based on certain interventions. And I actually had a lot of fear built into my programming. And that has been untied and undone over the years through my conversations with Shalina. And we have realized how important it is that we get some of this information out into the public and what people actually need to know, what to expect when you're expecting, right? So thank you for coming on the show, Jessica. And tell us, who are you?
Thanks for having me. My business name is Birth Takes a Village, and I've been attending births as a doula for about over 10 years now. I can't quite remember. I've lost track a little bit. So I attend births, which started out as primarily being hospital births and eventually led into being primarily home births. I also teach a doula training doulas on understanding the birth process and how to support families through pregnancy and birth. And I teach prenatal classes as well. I think teaching is one of the favorite things that I've done over the years, because I think attending births is so sacred and special and amazing, but teaching people to feel powerful in their own bodies and capable of making their own choices just feels like it has such a bigger community and far-reaching impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're a birth expert, you're a doula trainer, and I'm excited to have a conversation with you. Shalina?
Hey, I wanted to ask you if you could just explain what a doula is first. And the thing that I want to acknowledge here today is that, you know, the majority of people listening are often men on this podcast. And one of the reasons that I'm so excited to have you here is because I feel that you bring just this beautiful blend of science and fact with also understanding the sacredness of birth. And so there's this really beautiful blend of that masculine need to understand something and that feminine blend of, you know, caring for and nurturing the space around the experience of birth. But just so we could give people an intro, like, what is a doula and why is that important?
Mm-hmm. I think I just want to comment on the science part of me, because I think people who hear that you attend births or you appreciate birth as like a beautiful and sacred thing immediately think that it's only about some kind of like emotional and spiritual experience, when that is not how I came to birth work at all. My background was doing an undergraduate studies in sciences, so primarily human biology and physiology. And what called me to birth work was actually the like obsessive science nerd in me, who, when I first started learning about birth and started learning myself what a doula was in kind of obsessively reading the research, led me down a huge and kind of eye-opening path of what like the science really says about birth and the types of providers that attend birth and the outcomes associated with those. When I first started being a doula, nobody really knew what a doula was. It's starting to be a little bit more common now. The best way I can think of to describe it is that we kind of have like an archetype in our mind of what a midwife is in our culture, as the kind of historic woman in the community who would sit with families and educate them prenatally, during birth and postpartum, and care for them in like emotional and health related ways. In modern times, our approach to birth has become quite clinical and has become primarily in the hands of doctors and obstetricians, and now medically trained midwives. Midwives have become a regulated part of our medical profession in many parts of the world, including here locally. And the best way I can describe the doula's role is that when midwives became regulated, there was kind of a division of labor between the role of the midwife that included the more kind of clinical, health-based, knowing what advice to give in kind of health situations, how to intervene when something goes wrong, diagnosing things and treating things in pregnancy and birth and postpartum, and the kind of community caregiver support role of the educator in the community, the person who's teaching people what to expect and what the process is going to look like, and understanding their bodies and actually sitting with families as they prepare and then give birth and move into the postpartum period. So typically we work with families prenatally, preparing them for birth, educating them for birth, helping them understand what their options are, figuring out what choices are in line with what they want from their birth. And then during the birth themselves, we go to their home and we sit with them throughout the birth process until either it's an appropriate time to go to the hospital or time for the midwife to come and join them at home. I often think of stories that you hear in our community of going to the hospital and getting sent home. I'm going to the hospital and getting sent back home. Going to the hospital and getting sent back home. The doula's role is to be the person that comes to the family and can sit with them in that kind of early birthing part where it's actually not advised or appropriate to go to the hospital yet, and help them through experience be comfortable at home for as long as possible until it's an appropriate time to kind of make the move to where you want to be if you're birthing in the hospital.
Great. Yeah. So it's like a birth counselor, like a consigliere, and like a emotional support, which sounds like, I think some people, maybe first time birthers might think like, oh, why would we need that? And like, we'll just like go to the hospital when it's time and get her done. Mm-hmm. But I think people, once they've had at least one child, probably get the point that it's like a very intense time. And having someone who knows their way around the block is very, very, very valuable. Like, a lot of people have an elder or a coach or a teacher. Like, everybody has teachers of various kinds in their lives. And when we don't know something, we go find a professional who does, and we learn from them. And the sort of cultural unconscious question that came to mind as you were talking was like, but Jessica, what is there to learn about birth?
Right.
Because like, I grew up thinking that there's not really much to learn and that like, it's also not my job mm-hmm. because the doctors at the hospital know what to do and we just need to like show up and let them do their job. Right. And so that's my first hilarious question.
It's like, I have so many answers to it. I don't know where to start. I mean, I think part of that is birth has been really kind of denormalized in our culture, where 100 years ago, we would have grown up watching our moms give birth and our sisters give birth and our cousins give birth. We would have seen our siblings give birth. It would have been a normal part of our culture. And then throughout the kind of modernization in the last few generations, we've moved it kind of behind closed doors into the realm of the experts and kind of taken knowledge from birth away from the community. And so what we're left with is our kind of Hollywood representation of birth, where everyone who has a baby, the birth starts with your waters breaking. It's a mad panic to get to the hospital. The birthing person hates her husband for a while, and then she has like one long, half an hour long contraction while she's screaming, and then someone pulls out a 3-month-old baby out of her body with no umbilical cord. And yeah. That's like, even though I think we know in our normal lives, like TV does not accurately represent a lot of things, we have no other frame of reference for it in our culture because we don't really learn about it in school health class. And we don't grow up witnessing it or being taught about it, taught about how our bodies work in that way or about how our communities, our partners' bodies work in that way. You know, even starting in like what we do learn in school health class, I mean, I don't know if they do this exactly anymore, but when we grew up, like in our generation, like even when we learned about our menstrual cycle, it was like all the girls go in this room to like learn about your period and all the boys go to a different room and who knows what they were doing. And so
learning about our penises or something. I don't know.
So it's like not only in those classes, like we didn't actually learn anything useful and learn anything about birth. And we also really excluded like the male population from that conversation. So I think not only do men have a lot to learn about birth, but women do too, because we are almost as badly off as everybody else is. I think part of the problem, and you know, part of the reason that we need to learn about birth and understand how our bodies work is because it's not a rare medical complication that like maybe flukily we will come across and need to just put our hands in the ER doctor for. It's a normal phase of our reproductive life cycle. That's a healthy kind of physiological state for us to be in. And not understanding how our bodies work or how the birth process works is really disempowering for both pregnant people and their partners when they're going through like a huge life-changing, emotional, family-changing event together and being so powerless in the process to know what their choices are, what's happening, why it's happening. The reality of birth is so much different than what TV makes it look like that people aren't prepared for the fact that birth actually isn't like an hour-long panic to get to the hospital unless it's maybe your fourth baby. Mm-hmm. It's like a long, several days long process that takes time and has like some really specific requirements for encouraging it to go smoothly and setting us up for our best chances of our families having smooth and healthy births that are positive experiences instead of the traumatic ones that we so often and popularly hear about in our culture. There's some statistics around PTSD, so post-traumatic stress disorder, being at least as common in childbirth as it is in war. Mm-hmm. And that is crazy for something that is a normal physiological state for us to be in.
Yeah, that's a huge problem.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because that's something that feels really close to my heart. Like, I used to be in birth work, probably like less than 0.5% of the births that you attended. But even in that experience for me, I felt traumatized mm-hmm. because I would sit down with these clients who would express their deepest desires to have this beautiful, calm, quiet, you know, peaceful birth experience. And then they'd tell me that they weren't open to a home birth.
Right.
And I would spend so much time doing my best to educate and inform them about the reality of what hospital birth is like compared to home birth, and fear one too many times.
Fear one.
And so, and then I would have to, you know, feel powerless in the situation of watching things happen that are inevitable in a hospital setting. Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned this piece around trauma, like the fact that we're having birth trauma and PTSD at the same rates as people who experience war, and we expect our population to be healthy, productive people with, you know, healthy families, it's just, it's really terrifying. And I wanted you to share a little bit about how not only men can get involved in this and support their families, but also sort of some of the myths around safety. Because when I've worked with couples, I've often found that either one or both of them have this fear that they need to be in the hospital in order to be safe. Mm-hmm. But it's oftentimes it's the things that they're expressing to me that they want to experience in birth. They need to be at home in order to have that experience.
Yeah.
And so what can you say about that to help A, men understand what's their real role in this process? And two, why do we need to rethink this idea of, you know, the hospital is the safest place to be?
Right.
Hospital versus home.
Right. Well, just to start off with, I think we do have a lot of misconceptions in our culture around what safety is in birth, where it's safe, and how we make birth safe. And that's why people end up going to the hospital too early or getting interventions more quickly than they should. Our local cesarean rate is almost 40% in the kind of average. National cesarean rate is close to 30% of people are entering a normal physiological process and ending up with major surgery. Even our medical system acknowledges that that is not normal or needed and is incorrect and not healthy. So what can we do to change that? And why is that happening? We have this belief that it's almost like a back rationalization thing that we do, where we live in a culture where most people give birth in the hospital. The only explanation we can come up with for that is that it must be safer to go there or people wouldn't go. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the research actually shows. When you look at the data on comparing place of birth between home birth and hospital birth, If you're just talking about live mothers and live babies at the end, the numbers are approximately the same. So you're just as likely to live in a planned home birth or in a planned hospital birth. But the risks of what we call morbidity as opposed to mortality in kind of the literature. So like higher risk of interventions, infections, things like that, all of those kinds of non-death related risks are higher in planned hospital births than planned home births, which surprises people. So just by planning to give birth in the hospital, you increase your risk of having a cesarean. If that was making birth safer and more people were living, that might be justified, but it's not. Just by planning to give birth in the hospital, we actually increase the risk of people bleeding too much, having a postpartum hemorrhage after birth. So that's one of the things, like one of the fears in our culture that we have stories or fears around is like, what if I have a hemorrhage? What if I bleed too much? Like, I need to be in the hospital for that. And so what's surprising is that even though that's part of the reason people think they need to be in the hospital, there's actually a higher chance of that happening just by being in the hospital. Similarly, there's a higher risk of infection to the mother and to the baby in a planned hospital birth than in a planned home birth. There's a higher chance of the baby needing to end up going to the neonatal intensive care unit and needing higher level medical care just by planning to be in the hospital. So all of these things there's so many things that we think we're going to the hospital just in case they happen for, just by walking in the door, we increase our chances of happening in the first place.
Yeah, it's almost like when I hear that, I'm like, wow, it's like walking into Best Buy increases my chances that I'm going to be walking out with a bunch of electronics. You know what I mean? Like, you go to the hospital for one thing. It's just like my business mind is activated. Like, wow, if this was like a business that was made so that just being in the building encouraged you to buy all the products, yeah, or like have to buy all the products, that is how it's working. Mm-hmm. Like, you just, it sucks you in. So, wow, yeah, that just that piece blows my mind about home birth versus hospital birth and the statistics and the chances of things going a certain way.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize too, there's a couple of things to kind of acknowledge within that. Number one, we do in Canada have a fee per service model of healthcare. So doctors do get paid more the more interventions they do in birth. You get paid more for a cesarean than if someone just has a vaginal birth. You get an anesthesiologist gets paid per 5-minute interval that a person is on an epidural for. So the earlier in birth you get an epidural, the more they get paid. I choose to believe that these may not be kind of consciously driving provider decisions that, you know, I want to do more interventions so that I get paid more, but it does kind of at least subconsciously influence the culture. And we know that when we look at places in Canada that compare fee per service models to salaried models for doctors, there's been some studies on just the prescription rates of antibiotics, which we know the overprescription of antibiotics in general public health is poor public health care and increases the risk of antibiotic resistance. Doctors who are getting paid a fee per service, which means they get paid for every prescription they write, prescribe more antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Doctors who get paid on a salary don't prescribe as many. And I think, you know, this is where we are in Canada. Because we have a public healthcare system, we forget that it's still a business because it's getting indirectly paid for through our taxes as opposed to us getting a bill like in the United States where it's more obvious that it's a business, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This I'm recalling so much right now as we're having this conversation of this movie that Shalina and I watched called The Business of Being Born, mm-hmm, where they exposed like how things in a hospital can, there can be this like cascading series of decisions made by the nurses or doctors and sort of strongly encouraged or forced upon the expecting mother that then really predict future consequences that often end up at cesarean or some kind of like emergency event that needs to happen. And for instance, just one of the basic things I remember seeing is that as soon as she's there and sort of preparing, she's laid on her back, right, or like kind of up, but on her back. And that isn't even really a natural position for giving birth. It's more of like almost a convenience factor or something for the doctors or like access to the access point, you know, it's like a ergonomic or something, but not for the mother or the baby.
No, I bet no one has ever once seen a pregnant cat giving birth roll over on her back and stick her legs up in the air.
Right. Like,
and that ends up stalling the pregnancy in some way, or probably in a number of ways. And then you have people coming around like going, we're checking the clock and your birth process is not going fast enough. Yep. And if it doesn't go fast enough, we're going to have problems. And so we're going to give you something to accelerate your birth process. We're going to like give you oxytocin or whatever it is. And then there's this like cascading effect of decisions that a person isn't necessarily prepared for.
Yeah.
And as soon as they go like, oh, okay, well, the doctors or the nurses have said that this is the right thing to do, so we're going to say yes to this, then there's all of these extra things that just come down the line. Like, oh, we've made this decision and now this one needs to happen. And then, so could you speak to that a little bit about like how the avalanche or the downhill slide can happen?
Yeah. Part of the problem is that birth is a very intricate hormonal physiological process, and we can't just intervene in one spot and then think the rest of the process is going to unfold really smoothly. One of the, in an otherwise normally, like normal healthy pregnancy, normal healthy baby, everything's normal and going smoothly, the kind of two things that tend to be at the kind of starting point of that case cascade of intervention is either being induced, so using medication to force the birth to start happening, or getting an epidural. And whichever one of those comes first typically leads to another one, to the, to the other. So if somebody gets an epidural, one of the biggest risks to epidurals, or one of the main problems with epidurals, is that it can slow birth down. Once birth slows down, then they want to give oxytocin, the medication, the induction medication, to speed it back up. The opposite can also sometimes happen, where someone's being induced. When you're being induced with medication, it kind of triggers the process in a way that's different than our natural physiology would trigger it and build into the process on its own. So people often describe the contractions and the sensations of an induced birth compared to a physiological birth as more abrupt, more sharp, more difficult to cope with, which means people are more likely to ask for an epidural. Because one's speeding it up and one's slowing it down, it's kind of like turning the heat and the air conditioning on at the same time, and you're trying to like balance it out, and sometimes it doesn't work very smoothly. Both epidurals and the medication that we use to induce people have side effects of their own. So the medication that we use for induction has a risk of being given in doses that are too strong for the baby to tolerate. And so they monitor the baby's heart rate really closely. Epidurals can sometimes cause what we call an epidural fever, where the woman will get develop a fever during pregnancy, during the birth process, because of the epidural. A fever can also be a sign of infection. So once you get a fever, they don't know, is there an infection, or is it just from the epidural, or is it okay? So then they have to start treating you like you have an infection. So now you're also probably on antibiotics, and now they're monitoring the baby's heart rate extra slowly. And now they've got you on a clock because they're worried about your progress, because the heat and the air conditioning being on at the same time isn't working that smoothly. And then you either run out of time according to their timelines, or the baby stops responding well to all of the medication that is being given to them, and people end up with what they would describe as an emergency cesarean as a result of that. So the just intervening, you can't just intervene in one part of the process and then have the body know what to do after that. It kind of triggers cascade, cascade, cascade. And then at the very end, everyone says, thank goodness we were in the hospital, because we needed to have this cesarean. Where yeah. It's like, if we had never intervened in the first place, the huge likelihood is that everything would have been smooth and fine and normal on its own. It's not to say that weird things never happen in birth, and that medical intervention is never something to be grateful for, to be appropriate, but it certainly should not be happening at the rates that it's happening. And it's very clear in the research and in my personal experience and observation that we are causing a lot more of the needed interventions than we're preventing.
About how many births have you attended?
I always say like close to 400. I've lost count, so I don't know if it's more or less than that, but I've attended hundreds of births. And I don't go to very many cesareans anymore. And it's not that they never happen, but when people are surrounded by people who truly understand how birth really works, their support people, their partners or their husbands or the father or whoever is their primary support person for the birth, it understands how to support them during the birth process. When they understand how their own bodies work, and we take this fear out of feeling like I just need to do whatever the doctor says, and I don't need to know anything, and I'm not qualified to know anything, like it's someone else's job to get the baby out of me. When we stop kind of seeing the pregnant woman as an object to like wrestle a baby out of and start seeing her as like a mammal that's giving birth in a healthy way. And she understands that. And the people who love her around her understand that and understand how to support her through it. And they feel less afraid, right? Because where does fear comes from? A lack of knowledge. When you feel unqualified and you feel like you don't know anything, then of course you're afraid and you surrender your power. But as soon as you have just a little bit of an understanding of what that process really looks like when we don't micromanage it unnecessarily, a lot of that fear starts to fall away and we start to see much better outcomes for families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that too around the fear piece, because I feel like a lot of times in our culture especially, it's similar with relationships. Like, we don't read a book about marriage until we're on the brink of divorce. We don't read anything about pregnancy until we're about to have a baby. And there's so many other things to be thinking about during that time. Like, your whole life is changing. And so what if we were to shift that, where birth and pregnancy and all of these things that are normal for us to experience in our lifetime were sort of weaved into our learning? And you mentioned how, you know, 100 years ago, many of us, almost all of us, would have seen healthy birth many times before giving birth. And that's why it wouldn't have been as scary, because we would have seen it and known. So what I'm seeing now is that this really starts in the very beginning of pregnancy, where any of the stuff that's coming up around fear or mindset needs to sort of be addressed right away, mm-hmm. so that a couple can have that safe container to navigate all the way through. And I think that a lot of couples don't realize what they're walking into. Like, they're very innocent in that, right? Mm-hmm. They think that they're doing the right thing by giving their power away, and that they're going to be safer that way. But what really needs to happen is that they need to take their power back and put the education and the information at the forefront, and like really look at the statistics. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned healthy birth. You know, you said, okay, well, if it's a healthy, normal pregnancy, and I can already hear all of the people saying, oh, well, I had to be in the hospital because of XYZ, or right. I had to have a cesarean section because XYZ.
Yeah.
And I hear it so often. And it's not that there's never a reason. I mean, my mom had a cesarean, and her placenta had ruptured. So it was legitimately an emergency. We're not like, oh, well, you should have just stayed home. You know, like,
yeah, you know, something really weird was
something
happening.
Something crazy happened, yeah. Right? But there were all these other reasons why what led up to that, right? So, but what I'm saying is I think we have, okay, sure, healthy pregnancy, but then we have all of these rebuttals.
Yes.
And I think that that's also built into the care model, where we go to our first appointments and then we're given all of these roadblocks. Mm-hmm. Where like, oh, well, you have to do this test and this test and this test. And there's just fear constantly. So how could we possibly believe that we have a chance at having a healthy pregnancy if we're already told that basically just by being pregnant, we're sick?
Right. Well, I know part of the problem is that we spend all of our pregnancies feeling like we have to prove we're healthy enough to give birth. We don't do that in any other context. You know, the only time a healthy person goes to the doctor or to the hospital is when they're having a baby. Doctors and hospitals are trained in testing for, diagnosing, and treating illness. They're not trained in like optimizing health. It's not really the model that they're trained in is not how do we care for healthy people having a healthy physiological experience. The same way, you know, we don't go to the doctor, like we were talking about before, we don't go to the doctor for nutrition advice.
Yeah, like our generation knows this. We know this. Like I'm not logging onto some governmental website to find out what I should do for my exercise regimen and my nutrition. Right? Like I'm listening to guys like Tim Ferriss and Dave Asprey, and I'm going on lifehacker.com and like Ben Greenfield, all these guys who for the most part don't really have qualifications per se, right? But they are like examples, and they have been like digging into that research, and that's their world. And I don't care if they're not doctors. Right. That's their scope. And our generation knows that we need to look to those guys for that information, right? If you want to find out about nutrition, you go to Google. You don't go to the hospital, right? Totally. And you experiment, you run some experiments on your life. But with birth, it's like, it seems like we're not doing that. And you know, going back to fear, I think fear is a large factor here. Like if you mess up on your diet, it's like, it just doesn't work, or like you gain a little bit of weight or whatever. But with birth, the consequences seem, they are higher. It's a big experience. It's like the biggest experience of your life as a woman. And there's, we all know like the horror stories, and all it takes is one person of the couple to have strong fear that they're not really willing to sort of overcome. They just want to soothe it.
Right.
They want to soothe the fear, and they're looking for a way to soothe the fear. And just one person in the couple can turn, plans for a lovely, smooth birth into like, well, let's take the shortest path to safety.
Right. And what does that mean, right? Like, what does safety mean? Part of the problem is kind of our cultural hypnosis on our perception of risk in childbirth and how risky it truly is. The risk of a baby dying in childbirth, dying like during the labor, is about the same risk that you as a like somewhat middle 30s male have of having a heart attack. But we accept that as a reasonable risk, and you are not living in a hospital right now with your heart hooked up to a monitor being like, is your heart still okay? 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 We know that like life is uncertain and weird, fluky things happen sometimes, but we've blown our expectation and assumptions about how high those chances are in childbirth so out of proportion that we have much more fear than we need to be. So going back to what you were saying earlier in regards to, you know, these reasons of I had to be in the hospital and thank goodness I was in the hospital, or I would have died, or my mom would have died, or my wife would have died if we hadn't been in the hospital, or these stories that you hear come from a lot of urban legends about what we believe to be unsafe about birth. So a really kind of common scenario you'll hear is, you know, thank goodness we were in the hospital because I had to have an emergency cesarean. If you look at the statistics, the number one reason for an emergency cesarean is slow progress in labor. Not someone was about to die, not the baby was about to die, not the mother was about to die, but it was taking too long, and so we did a cesarean. But we call those an emergency cesarean in our culture. And certainly if you're the couple in the hospital room having that experience, it can feel like an emergency. Hospitals only have one or two ORs in them, and they're scarce commodities. And once a decision is being made to use one, they need to get you in so that they can get you out in case someone actually has an imminent, urgent emergency that's life-threatening, so that you're not hogging the OR while you're waiting, while someone else is waiting around for like imminently urgent care. And so once a decision is made for a cesarean for slow progress, or, you know, things like, let's kind of more of like a, yeah, this isn't going as quickly as we would like it to, we've kind of run out of time phase. Once we'd make the decision to have a cesarean, or once that decision is made, things start moving extremely quickly. And not only is it documented on your chart as either an emergent or urgent cesarean, it also feels very urgent. Whereas if you actually hear the whole story, it's nothing was imminently, scarily happening the way we perceive an emergency in any other context in life. But it feels urgent in the moment. And then that exasperates these stories of these all these emergencies that were happening. People often think, you know, I had to have a cesarean because I was breech. Some babies need to be born by cesarean, but there's good research that vaginal birth is often a much better option than cesarean birth for breech babies, but people don't know that. So people will say, what if the baby's breech? Like, then you'd need to be in the cesarean. You need to have a cesarean, and you need to be in the hospital. People will say, well, I hemorrhaged, so I needed to be in the hospital. Like, thank goodness I was there because I bled too much after birth. Well, being on artificial oxytocin, that drug we were talking about, that is often used to either induce or speed up labor, increases your risk of bleeding too much. So what happened leading up to that caused the hemorrhage in the first place? Do they flukily happen sometimes at home? Yes, and then they're managed at home or people move to the hospital. But they're often what we perceive to be these like emergency, thank goodness I was in the hospital scenarios, were actually caused by being there in the first place.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, because that's kind of one of the main things that I want people to hear, is actually our perception can be much different than the reality of what's actually going on in these circumstances. And, you know, being in a hospital room when we're in the birthing process alone is quite jarring for the nervous system. And so we've seen, you know, how you have a woman who is laboring normally and the birth process is going normally, and then they decide to go to the hospital, and what do you know, everything stops and now there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it goes downhill, and it's like, well, you take somebody who's in the most vulnerable experience of their life, where their body is totally taking over and going into this animal state, and then we put them in these bright lights with these beeping things, and we're like, let me put my hands in you, like, I've never met you before, but like, hey, I'm just gonna get on in there, and there's all these people talking, and it's, of course your body might shut down. That makes perfect sense to me that might happen. And yet then we say, well, your body's not working properly, we need to deal
your
with this,
your body's broken,
you are broken. It has nothing to do with everything that we're doing here and this whole environment.
Couldn't be us.
Couldn't be.
You know, I think the best analogy for men specifically that I've ever seen for that is there is this amazing YouTube video. I can't remember what it's called, but it's called something like If Birth Were Like Sex. And in the video is a couple that is going to the hospital because they want to conceive a baby. And in this analogy, it's the man that's being monitored. So they go in. They want to conceive a baby. The doctors check the man's temperature. They take his blood pressure. They put heart rate monitors on his chest. They stand in front of him, tell him to get undressed, give him a hospital sex outfit to put on, give the woman some slippers. And then they say, okay, all your vitals are good. We're going to step outside of the room. You guys make a baby. They go step outside of the room. The guy's got monitors on. They can hear people with clipboards outside of the room monitoring, talking about him. Every once in a while they're coming in, he's like on top of the woman, the doctor comes in, pops a thermometer in his mouth, says, oh no, you're in the wrong position, that's not gonna work, you need to put your leg up here, oh no, it's not gonna work like this, your temperature's going up.
Tell me they're checking his erection too, like, yeah, your erection's not working.
Yeah. And they're like kind of like making faces, like, you know, because, and then he's looking at his wife like, I'm sorry, like, this just isn't working, because it's like, it's not gonna work, like, you can't really, like, men can't really have sex under those conditions. And then in the end they're like, give up on him, they say, okay, it's been a while, like, obviously this isn't working, but don't worry, like, we have specialists that can like fertilize the egg for you. And then the final clip is the couple sitting there being interviewed saying, like, we're just so grateful to our doctors. We couldn't have done this without them. Like, I really thought, the man is saying, I really thought this is something I could do naturally, but for just whatever reason, I couldn't. So I'm so grateful we had this great medical care so that we could make a baby. And when you think about that, like, it is insane. Like, if you were trying to have sex and like knock up your wife, if you were doing it in a room full of bright lights with someone monitoring you, inspecting you, criticizing your every move, telling you were doing it wrong, you would not be able to get your wife pregnant. Like, the failure to progress would definitely happen. Yeah. But that's how we treat women when they're in the birth process, is we take them into this, all of the same hormones that we need for sex are the same hormones that move birth along. So oxytocin, which there's an artificial form of oxytocin that is the drug we've been referencing in terms of inducing and speeding up birth, but natural oxytocin is the hormone produced in our own body. And it's the love hormone and the bonding hormone and the hormone that causes contractions to birth your baby. And it's the orgasm hormone. And it does all of these things together. And it requires a really specific environment to work. Our stress hormones inhibit oxytocin.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so the higher our stress hormones are, the more they inhibit and stop our natural oxytocin from working. And when women are in an environment with lots of bright lights, with authority figures looking at their body, putting their fingers in their body, acting like they know more about their bodies than they do, setting them up to feel unsafe and vulnerable, that is not a context for natural oxytocin to work properly.
So right there, that's the setup, right? Is like the environment.
Yeah.
And so just knowing that piece, it's so easy to draw the line between what you were saying about the predictability of home births versus hospital births and how you're basically better off at home. Because in terms of the cascading effects that occur at a hospital, after we've outlined that and we look at, okay, well, what's the start point being one of the main start points being this oxytocin release, that like you're almost surely going to stall that if you leave the comfort of your home. Totally. Or whatever, wherever you're choosing to birth. Like if you're not choosing to birth in a hospital, it's usually in some comfortable place, right?
Yes.
And so it's a setup.
It's a setup.
Mm-hmm. I love what you mentioned too about the sex piece, because that's something that I feel we've totally removed, where birth is no longer sexual, mm-hmm. even though birth is totally sexual. Like, how do you think you got here?
Right? Yeah. What is,
how did you get pregnant without sex? Right? It's like, and is that wrong? Like, and the reason that we want birth to not be sexual is because how could we possibly allow it to be sexual when it's with someone we've never met, like this OB, mm-hmm. or when it's in this sterile environment and where it's in this place that sex doesn't belong? So we've removed sex, not because it's not a natural part of birthing, but because it's no longer safe to have that there. And so when we're in this home environment and we can bring that sexuality back to it, it's sort of like when, so, you know, for the men listening, or if you're listening with your partner, you know, we talk about holding space, mm-hmm. right? And so especially in the sexual nature, when we're holding space for our partner to open, when we're holding space for her so she can surrender and so she can go to these depths of her orgasm or whatever it is. Same thing in birth, really. We're holding space, we're holding a container so that somebody can open and go to the deepest place inside of them to surrender and to bring their baby earthside. And I think that that's like the piece that we forget. And it's the difference between couples coming out of birth more bonded and closer than ever so that they can navigate this new chapter, and, or being traumatized and totally disconnected. Mm-hmm. And so it's having a healthy birth experience and having this knowledge isn't just about, you know, having a healthy baby or the woman having a better experience. This is also couples and their marriages mm-hmm. that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're strengthening the longevity of a relationship and a marriage. We're creating deeper intimacy for the couple as well, rather than having them just totally traumatized and destroyed by that experience they just had.
Totally.
Yeah. I think it's important to I just want to add a few things about that piece with the couple, because yeah, this is a really intense experience. And for women, I don't even know where to go with this. It's a huge test. It's a huge test for a relationship. And the ideal scenario is that regardless of what happens, you come out of that experience feeling like you're on the same team. Mm-hmm. And like the woman feels supported by the man. And yeah, if I could say like, what's your job, guys? Going into and coming out of a birthing experience is to make sure that she feels like you've got her back. So you need to figure out what you need to do to have her back, mm-hmm. right? And so that's why we're having this conversation right now, is like, how can things be set up so that your partner is essentially violated by the system of cascading events? And how can you be complicit in that decision, mostly due to giving into the fear and trying to give away the power to the professionals? So for myself, like this has been a very interesting learning curve, and knowing that part of me supporting you, Shalina, if we do end up in the hospital, which we'd rather not, obviously, if we end up there, that like when you're in an incapacitated state where you're high and you can't, like can't even speak, maybe I'm gonna need to speak for you or advocate. Let's just say that, advocate for you and for your rights and for what I know you want or don't want. And I might have to give some firm no's to some people and stand in my fear and know that like, okay, I'm gonna like stand up for this even though I'm scared and I wanna give the power away so that I'm not responsible, right? That's my responsibility, is to stand up and not let fear own me, you know? And that's been what I've been learning in my own life. And it's important as a couple that we navigate that in a way where we don't come out of it where you feel betrayed by me, right? Or abandoned by me, like I wasn't there for you. So there's a lot to learn here going into birth.
I think men often get put in a very horrible and unjust position in the hospital, which is why men have just as many horror stories and bad experiences coming out of birth as women do, because they are often very excluded from the process in a hospital setting. And they're often put in impossible situations where a doctor is making a recommendation and the woman is saying, no, I don't want that. I don't want that vaginal exam right now. No, I don't want the epidural. No, I don't want to be induced. She's saying no. And the doctor will often turn to the partner and look at him and then start convincing him why she needs it. And then the partner is in this impossible position where he feels totally unqualified to make the decision on her behalf. Every instinct in his being is saying, like, this is my family, this is my whole life, this is my first opportunity to step up as a protector of this family. And she's not listening to the doctor, and I know it's my job to support her, but I also don't want it to be on me if she dies or the baby dies or the doctor is making me feel like that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, of course sometimes the partner accidentally throws the birthing woman under the bus because he's just been put in this position of like an authority figure, a perceived authority figure, looking at him and saying, you need to convince your partner to do this or something bad might happen. Mm-hmm. And even if you're like, heart wants you to stick up for her, you feel like very backed in a corner. It's a completely immoral and unjust position for anybody to ever be putting a partner or a father in the first place. Like, it's actually beyond immoral that they do that, but they do that, and it can happen. And then people do often finish their births feeling like their partner betrayed them or didn't stick up for them or didn't have their back. One of my favorite births I was ever at in the hospital, which if you talk to me enough, you'll realize I say about almost every birth I've ever been to. Anyway, it's one of my favorite births I was ever at. Was this woman who is having her first birth had been a cesarean in the hospital. Her second birth, she was planning a vaginal birth after her cesarean, again, planning a hospital birth. We were in the hospital. Like, we stayed home for quite a long time until she was quite far into the process. We moved to the hospital. Things were going quite smoothly. Things were going pretty quickly, or fairly smoothly, in my opinion. And at some point, the doctor thought she'd been pushing for too long and really wanted to use forceps to pull the baby out. She very confidently looked at the doctor and said, no, I can tell this is working. The baby's coming. I just want to push out my baby. The doctor turned and looked at the father and said, you know, forceps sound really scary, but they're not actually that scary. Like, we're just going to, what we'll do is we'll just like slip this instrument over your baby's head and just help the baby come out. And it's really important because blah, 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 blah. The dad, who'd been through this the first time with the cesarean that was unwanted, looked at the doctor and just stared at him deadpan and said, my wife declined the forceps. No. And then the doctor just kind of stared at him speechless because people don't normally react like that. And then she had her baby maybe 20 minutes later or something. And it was so amazing to see him not be afraid to say, like, you know, I might not be qualified to make that decision, but I don't have to be, because she's already said no. And I don't need to, it's not my job to make her change her mind or to be afraid if she's making the wrong choice. It's my only job is to stand up for what she's saying, like relieving yourself from the pressure of being like, you have to be the expert that knows the answer or needs to make the decision on her behalf, and know that your job is to just reiterate what she's saying and say what she says, what she's saying goes. Like, I'm with her. I know what she wants. This is what she said she wanted. Like, you're not going to convince me to convince her to change her mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, right? Because, you know, when you said like, well, if we end up at the hospital and then, you know, what would we do? And in my reality, the only way we'd be at the hospital is if I was like unconscious or something. You guys are like, oh my God, she's literally dying. We like need to go. Like an
actual emergency is happening.
Like legitimately, right? Because actually, like, I'm terrified to go to a hospital to give birth. Like, I've just seen too much. Mm-hmm. I can't go back. It's kind of like, you know, it's just too real for me. I know the realities of what happens in hospitals. And so I guess what I'd love to do with you right now, because, you know, we're running low on time, is I have a few kind of more rapid fire questions. Just, you don't have to go super fast, but there's,
yeah, let's get into some myth busting.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I have a few things that I want to cover with you around this so that we can help people understand what the truth is around, you know, things like, so we talked about this idea of healthy pregnancy. So some of the things that have driven me crazy over the years were my baby's too big.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to let you cover that one, but that's the age old myth and it's still kicking live today.
Yeah.
So my baby's too big. I'm a geriatric person because I'm giving birth at 35 or heaven forbid, I'm pushing out a baby at 41. I'm basically already a senior citizen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this idea of I need to be in the hospital just in case anything goes wrong. And this idea that, you know, midwives aren't qualified to resuscitate a baby, or I'd like you to touch on the reality of what can an OB actually do? How qualified are they to resuscitate a baby versus a midwife? Who do we really want to go to if there's trouble with the baby?
Right.
And I would love to just kind of talk about any kinds of myths that you hear come up a lot that people are convinced that they are somehow broken or need to be, you know, in the specialized care because they've already been told that something that's totally normal isn't normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? We're going to go top 10 here.
Okay.
Top 10 myths.
Well, let's start off with the big baby thing because that is, I mean, it's just completely insane for so many reasons. You know, we hear a lot of stories in our generation of like, well, my family just had to have cesareans because we all have small pelvises and the baby doesn't fit through our pelvis. Or, my doctor says my baby's growing a little bit too big, so we need to have a cesarean. It's going to be too big to fit. A large baby is actually not a medically indicated reason for a cesarean. It's not on the list. Like, if you look in the obstetric guidelines, big baby is not a qualifier for a cesarean. And part of the reason for that is, you know, I think what it really comes down to is we've objectified the female body so much to view it as a passive object with a hole in it that something big needs to fit out of. And we've stopped seeing it as like a functional process that is an active biological process that's mobile. Our pelvises are not just a bowl with a hole in the bottom that either something fits through or it doesn't. Our pelvis is four bones that are held together. I always kind of think of it as being elastic banded together by tendons and ligaments in our body. And our pelvis opens up during birth. So our pelvis is not the size during birth, the birth process, as it is when we're not pregnant. Yeah. It opens up to allow for a baby to move through. Similarly, a baby is not just a one-sized object that either fits through or doesn't fit through. The baby actually shapes themselves to the size of our pelvis, which is why, you know, we all know, or most of us have either seen a newborn or have held a newborn baby, and we know to be like mindful of the two soft spots on their head. So their babies are born with their skull plates. We all have five skull plates in our skull. And when we're born, those plates are separated. They're not fused together like they are when we're adults. They're separated. And that leaves two soft spots in your head where there's kind of a gap between the bones. That's for birth. So the reason that we have those is because part of the birth process is the baby molding their heads, so folding those skull plates over top of each other to make a shape that will fit through the pelvis. So even if you have a big baby, they will shape their heads to fit through your pelvis at the same time as your pelvis is opening to allow them to move through your body. Just a few decades ago, it was very common practice to do what was called pelvimetry, which sounds very fancy, where they would do a vaginal exam prenatally, insert their fingers into the woman's body, and feel how much space there was in her pelvis. And they would diagnose her with having either an adequate pelvis for birth or an inadequate pelvis for birth. And if you had an inadequate pelvis for birth, you'd be scheduled a cesarean. So that's where that, like, my family has small pelvises story comes from. That was never evidence-based. There was never any science to support it. The size that your pelvis might be during a random prenatal exam has nothing to do with how much it's going to open during the birth process. But one of the most important things to remember about maternal healthcare and obstetrics and our medical system that we rely on so heavily as, like, the experts in medical care is that maternal healthcare is notoriously the least evidence-based of all areas of medicine. And a lot of the things that have become common practice over the years are things that never had any science or evidence to back them up to start doing in the first place. And now that we're starting to realize our cesarean rates are too high, our intervention rates are too high, people are getting traumatized, this isn't working, we're having to do all of this research to justify stopping doing practices that never had any evidence to support them in the first place. And the big baby legend is one of those examples.
Mm-hmm. So well said. I am in part of the birth community online, and so I get the pleasure of hearing announcements when big babies are born. And one of my favorites was, because I'm like 4'9 or 4'10, I'm super tiny, I'm like 90 pounds, and I've had people throughout my life say, well, could you even give birth, like, you're so small, you know? And I'm like, well, my mom did it and my cousins did it and they're all pretty small too. And, you know, I've been to Asia and all of those women seem to be doing it just fine as well. So, you know, but it was my favorite because, you know, there was a time where I saw, I think it was like Gloria LeMay or something, said she was over with some 4'10, you know, really tiny woman. She gave birth to a 10-pound baby vaginally at home. Everything was fine, no tears. And I think that we have this idea, like you said, of this, like, a woman is an object and her body is that size and absolutely nothing changes when the baby's coming out.
Right.
So it's just a good reminder to...
We're quite stretchy beings in general. Like, our pelvises stretch, our tissues stretch, our babies squeeze. Like, it's a very good design if we allow space for it to work. But when we start off, like, the process of, you know, planting these seeds of doubt in our bodies before we're even pregnant, never mind once we are pregnant, then we are starting off with this self-doubt and lack of confidence right off the bat.
Yeah, I'm reminded that when you were telling a story about 10 minutes ago, you were saying that in the hospital, they'll say, like, you're not progressing fast enough. And my question was, fast enough for who? Like, on whose watch is this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a whole speech I'd like to give on that, but I'll try to condense it. There was this fellow named Dr. Friedman, who was a doctor, who did some of the kind of early research on how long each phase of birth should take and how long was too long and how to recognize what's abnormal progress. He did, because that's the question everyone has, is how long is too long? How do we know it's going fast enough? How do we know things are progressing quickly enough and that we don't need to intervene? And so he decided to try to answer that question. In the study that he did, he found that there's very irregular progress in early labor. This is the early part of labor. We don't really care how long it takes up until a certain point where we reach what we call the active phase of labor. So before active labor, it can take really any length of time. It's totally unpredictable. We don't care how long and slow it is. But once you're in active labor, his research found that people should be dilating at a rate of 1 centimeter every 1 to 2 hours. And he made this fancy graph that became known as Friedman's curve for a model of normal birth progress. Unfortunately, there is like a number of problems with this study. For one thing, when he did the study, he did it on a sample size of about 400 or 500 women, which is not very big. When we're looking at kind of population level studies, you want to look at groups of like thousands or tens of thousands in order to extrapolate from them any kind of really useful data, not a couple hundred. The women in the study, this small study, were between the ages of 14 and their early 40s. So like very different women at very, very different hormonal phases in their lives. It was done in an era where it was done in the early 1950s, in a time where most women were heavily medicated and sedated on hallucinogenic drugs like scopolamine.
Oh God.
Tied down to the bed with leather straps, and most babies were pulled out with forceps. It's an era that, like, the name of that kind of care in birth was called twilight sleep, and the catchphrase of the time was drug them up, tie them down, and pull them out. And it's like that model is what we still use today to have an understanding of birth progress. Now, providers today will say, oh, we don't use Friedman's curve anymore. But what they mean by that is we've changed what our definition of active labor is over time. So at the time of Friedman's curve study, active labor was defined at 3 centimeters of dilation. So when we're talking about dilation, we're talking about how open the cervix is in the uterus to open up to let the baby out. Pre-birth, you're 0 centimeters dilated. We call being fully dilated 10 centimeters. I could go on a whole other tangent about that, but just to keep for simplicity's sake, dilating in birth means going from 0 centimeters to 10 centimeters. At the original time of this study, the dividing line was labeled as 3 centimeters. So before 3 centimeters, we don't really care about progress. It's only after 3 centimeters that we expect this certain speed to happen, 1 centimeter every hour or two. Many years ago, they decided to reevaluate. We know our cesarean rate is too high. We know we're speeding up too many births, intervening in too many births, doing too many cesareans. So we're always looking at why, I'm including myself in the medical institution, even though I'm decidedly not part of it. The medical institution acknowledges their cesarean rate is too high in a lot of ways. So they're re-looking at the research. When they redid the research on how long birth should take, they discovered, oh no, 3 centimeters is actually too early. It's actually 4 centimeters. We shouldn't care about how fast birth is progressing until at least 4 centimeters of dilation. And then we expect this regular progress. A handful of years ago, more research was done because our cesarean rate is still too high. So we've reevaluated the study again and progress again. And the kind of latest assessment a handful of years ago was that, oh no, 4 centimeters is actually way too early. We shouldn't be expecting this 1 centimeter every 1 to 2 hour progress until at least 6 centimeters of dilation.
Right.
So it's changed this many times in the time span that I've been attending births in the last 10 years. So I don't know what that tells you, but what that tells me is we are using the wrong model.
Yeah.
So even though, you know, we don't use Friedman's original 500 person sample size, 1950s, 3 centimeters is active labor study anymore, we're still using that model, which says at some point we expect to hold you to a timeline and we'll diagnose your birth as being unhealthy and abnormal on the basis of speed at some point alone. And that's the part that we need to throw away.
Mm-hmm.
Just trash it.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is another favorite question that I always have, which is, I'm going to get to the geriatric comment, but first I want to talk about the comment that we hear from people that we're so lucky to have the medical system now because before everybody was dying from birth. And now they're not.
Right. So myth or no myth, was everyone dying from birth before hospitals came in and saved the day?
Yeah, that is one of the most, it's like It's like a very good marketing pitch to say, like, you need our service because everyone died before we existed. But a nice little fun fact is that women actually started dying in some of the most alarmingly high rates in history when birth first moved into the hospital. And what they were dying from was infection due to being in the hospital. This was like the era before understanding of bacteria and aseptic technique and not transferring infections from one patient to another. So when birth first moved into the hospital setting, maternal mortality rates actually went up. They're better at that now, although infection rates are still higher in hospitals than they are at planned home births. They're much better at keeping that risk a lot lower. But it's a complete myth that as soon as birth moved into the hospital, it became safer. The reality is that just being in the hospital actually introduces a level at risk. The people who went to the hospital when birth first moved into the hospital were poor people who couldn't afford or didn't have access to anyone else to attend their birth. People in cities living in poverty who had nowhere else to go. And they were dying. And so this story that we've been told is that women used to die all the time in childbirth. They did die in childbirth more commonly in certain scenarios and certain parts of our history, but it has never been directly correlated with whether or not they had access to a hospital. It could be correlated with access to food and nutrition and being nourished, healthy populations that are well to begin with. But it's not that hospitals came in and started saving the day. Certainly they have some tools that we're grateful to have. You know, if you for whatever reason have a fluke scenario like your mom did and you need an emergency cesarean, it's great that we have people who know how to do those in much safer ways now. If you are bleeding a little bit too much and you need a little bit of extra blood or things like that, it's great that we have places that know how to safely give those to us. But it's not true that planning to birth there before things go wrong is protecting you in any way and is in fact increasing your risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's bounce off of that because let's touch on this idea that we need to be in the hospital before it happens. Mm-hmm. So what I've learned is that actually midwives are really the people you want around if there's something going wrong with your baby, and that we're more than equipped to handle an emergency situation at home and also to know the signs of if we really need to get out of the house and go to the hospital. Can you touch on that?
Well, one of the issues is that we also have this illusion that just by being in the hospital means there's a whole team of emergency providers like sitting outside the door, twiddling their thumbs, waiting for you to have your baby. And they're not. Like, they're busy. They have other things to do. So just because you're in the hospital doesn't mean you're getting immediate access to emergency care. Most hospitals don't have an obstetrician that's on site all of the time or a pediatrician that's always on site all of the time. Some hospitals do. One of our local hospitals always has an OB and a pediatrician on site, but most hospitals don't. Most of the time, there's someone on call who's at home while you're in the hospital giving birth. And if they're needed, someone will call them to come to the hospital and help you. So they're not just waiting outside your door. The research that looks at the difference between time to treat in an actual emergency scenario in a home birth, planned home birth versus a planned hospital birth, is that as long as you're within about 30 minutes from a hospital, the time that you wait to get that kind of next level expert emergency intervention help is about the same whether you are birthing at home or birthing in the hospital. The only difference is who's moving. If you're in the hospital, by the time, you know, you need a cesarean fairly quickly, by the time they organize the team, prep the OR, get everything ready, you're just waiting in the labor room while they're doing that. And the only difference between that and being at home is that instead of you waiting in the labor room while they're getting that ready, you're going to the hospital while they're getting that ready. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Yeah. So there's actually not a huge difference, if any, as long as you're within a reasonable distance to a hospital. Arguably, it might be a little bit different if you're a helicopter ride away from the hospital, although there is some interesting research coming out on the safety of rural home births as well, which is surprisingly good and has surprisingly good safety outcomes. as well, arguing that it's just as safe as a home birth in the city. But just for simplicity's sake, there's much less of a disparity between the amount of time that you would need to get emergency medical treatment, regardless of where you birth, because the hospitals don't have infinite resources to have one OB and one pediatrician sitting outside the room of every single person that's there. In places like here, when you're talking about the registered midwives here who are trained medically and clinically in obstetrics, they're not only trained in but held to higher standards in emergency care than people in the hospital often are. So they're not going to do a cesarean at home, which is a good thing. Yeah. If you need one, you'll go to the hospital. But, you know, if you were bleeding a little bit too much at home, there's lots of things that they have, all the same things in their trunk of their car that the labor room in the hospital has. They just have a portable version for it. So the registered midwives here carry medications to treat bleeding if you do have a little bit too much bleeding. They, A, need it less often than people who are in the hospital. B, if they do need it, it works quite well. See, if it's not working as well as they want, then they move you to the hospital while they're using what they do have. Similarly with helping babies, like what if the baby's born and needs help breathing? The registered midwives here, the kind of national standard for medical birth attendants to train in how to resuscitate a baby that needs help breathing at birth is to recertify once every 2 years. Registered midwives here, because they attend home births, are required to retrain every single year. So you have two people at a home birth who are very up to date on those skills, at least as well, if not often better, than the people in the hospital are. And the difference is that it's typically, you know, there are people who know you, who are comfortable with you, who are connected to you, who know each other, who know their role at a birth how to work together in an emergency situation. And they usually handle it quite calmly and gently in a way that feels much less scary. Where in the hospital, number one, babies are very good at breathing when they're born. It is my belief that most of the time they breathe in spite of the insane things we are trying to do to save them, as opposed to because of all these things we're trying to do to save them. At a home birth, you know, they're already so much better off because of the environment and the safety that we've given the birth and the third stage and this kind of environmental safety that we provide for the birthing person and for the baby. But the odd time I have seen a baby who was given a little bit of help, medical help to breathe, has only ever reassured me about how safe it is to be at home. In the hospital, if that flukily happens, they cut the umbilical cord, they take the baby away from the parents, they put them in a tray in the corner, a whole SWAT team of medical professionals run into the room, stand around the baby. They often argue over who's doing what and where to stand and what to do. The parents can't see the baby, so even though the baby might be moving and pinking up and starting to take their first breaths, nobody's looking at the parents or talking to the parents, and they can't see the baby, so it goes on for much longer for them than it's going on for the baby and feels very terrifying. At a home birth, number one, midwives should be and usually do leave the umbilical cord intact, which there's tons of research that says leaving the umbilical cord intact when a baby needs help breathing is safer for the baby because it's the baby's still getting oxygen from the mother's blood supply to sustain them while they're learning how to breathe or realizing they were born or whatever is going on. So their outcomes are better just because they're still connected to the mother and getting an oxygen supply from her. There's no strangers in the room. So the mother has her hands on the baby. The dad, if he's there, or the partner who's there, has his hands on the baby. They can see their baby and talk to their baby and notice the signs of improved health. They've got two calm midwives there who are communicating with each other in a calm and slow and professional way, so that even when this, and they're using the same techniques and the same skills to care for the baby, but they're doing it in a way that A, is and more effective, and B, isn't as scary for the parents.
Yeah. That's good. What about the cord wrapped around the neck?
Yeah. So that's, Ooh. That's a big one that I sometimes, it's become so normal to me that I forget that people are even scared of that until, like, sheepishly people will bring it up. I'll tell a story about the dad catching the baby and unwinding the cord from around the body, and someone will say, like, what? Isn't that a huge emergency? And I'm like, oh, right. Like, we believe that. Having the cord wrapped around the baby's neck or body in one way or the other is a total variation of normal. About 30% of babies are born with the cord around their neck. That's not a low number. One out of every three babies. Mm-hmm. And it is extremely rare that it would cause any dangerous issue at all. I think the reason we have this cultural fear around what if the cord is around the neck, how would you know? Like, I would have a home birth if I could know the cord, if only I could know the cord wouldn't be around the neck, is more of like a visual fear. Like, we don't visually like the appearance of a cord that looks like a noose tied mm-hmm. around a little baby's neck. Mm-hmm. Babies are not breathing through their lungs when they're inside your body. They're getting oxygen through the umbilical cord. So they're not, we can't really strangle their oxygen supply through their throat because they're not breathing through their lungs. In theory, it could be tight and maybe like decreased circulation or something like that. But it's not like the image that we get of like someone being hung by a noose is not relevant to a cord being around a baby's neck. Most babies who are born with a cord around the neck, when they have calm people who recognize it as a variation of normal, it's not even an issue. Like, it's more, you know, as you're pulling the baby up to your chest, or the dad's catching the baby, or you're catching your baby together, you just notice, oh, the baby's kind of tangled up in their cord, and you unwind the baby. Like, it's kind of a non-issue. If in a very small number of circumstances, the cord is tight, the head is born, and the cord is tight enough that it's kind of preventing the descent of the baby, the rest of the baby from being born, the midwife or the parents just push the umbilical cord down over the shoulder or pull it up over the head to just get it out of the way. Like, it's not rocket science. It's just, if it's in the way, you just move it out of the way.
I've seen this happen.
Yeah. And it's lubed up. Like, it's not like a dry rope.
No, that's just like exactly. Tight. It's a soft, squishy, jelly-like yeah. cord. Yeah.
So last thing would be, the geriatric. Well,
yeah, the age thing. Like, what about senior citizens who, is there a senior discount for for at the hospital when you're like over 36? Ever since my mother's generation, it's like, don't even try to have a kid after 36 because things are going to go bad.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of what was implanted into my mind.
Yeah. I mean, part of the insane thing about that is we all act like it's this brand new, like, modern thing that we're having babies past the age of 35, and it is very much not. Like, we only about two generations ago discovered anything about birth control or contraceptives and preventing pregnancy. We have been having babies in our 30s and early 40s until menopause for quite some time because we did not know how to stop ourselves from getting pregnant. The only thing that is new is that we're having our first babies mm-hmm. at that age. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, we've extrapolated that to mean like it's this new phenomenon that we're giving birth in our 30s when it's not. Like, maybe 50 years ago, we would have been having our seventh or eighth baby by then, but we were still having babies by then. A 35-year-old is not geriatric. Like, that is insane. And when you look at the research around, like, different risks for birth past the age of 35 or 40 or whichever number, whichever the study is actually using, they often don't separate completely healthy people into a group on their own. Mm. So, just because you're 35 or 40 and you're at a higher risk of health diseases in general, which may impact a birth, does not mean you have those diseases. You could be 35 or 40 years old and extremely healthy, extremely fit, and extremely good, have like everything on your side to have a very smooth and healthy birth. You could be 20 years old and have a lot of serious health issues or nutritional status issues that are stacked against you a little bit. So even though we've kind of put people into this category of, oh, like, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, where we spend our whole prenatal care trying to prove we're healthy enough to have a baby. Instead of having the assumption be you're healthy enough, you're healthy until proven otherwise. There's an old book written by an obstetrician called Looking for Trouble. Mm-hmm. And in it, he talks a lot about how if you look hard enough for a problem, you're going to be able to find one, and then we're going to have to treat it.
Yeah.
But why are we looking so hard to convince ourselves a problem exists, instead of what we do in everything else really in healthcare is keep the person healthy. And if something weird is happening, we'll look into it.
Yeah. And trust, right? like you've said this a number of times, like the human body is a fantastically capable thing that is built for this. Mm-hmm. Right. And we need to learn to trust that. And we, like you said, we do this in so many other ways in our lives. Like every time we get into a car, we know that there's a risk that we could get in a car accident. We try not to be the cause of that accident, but we know that even if someone else hits us, we're in a thing that is made to sustain that kind of a hit, and that, you know, more than likely we're going to be okay, especially at this day and age. And we get into the car not fearing the whole time and driving around anxiously. Hopefully most of us don't. We just trust. We trust that there's a process, and, you know, that if we're going to get T-boned by a semi truck, like, geez, maybe my time is just up. But we just kind of like, we just let that go. And we have a degree of faith when it comes to driving a vehicle or plenty of other things, right? Food poisoning from restaurants. And like, we're just like, okay, there's a system set up for this. And with birth, there is a system set up for it, and it's in you right now. And we need to learn to have faith in nature. And as a man, I need to learn to have faith in my partner's nature. And so much of this conversation is really about, you know, addressing fear. Mm-hmm. And how do we deal with fear? And I think that's basically the main issue in this culture, is that we pander to fear. We just run for our lives. We give our power away. And we try to soothe our fear. We try to medicate our fear. We anesthetize our fear. And it doesn't really work that well, you know? And so this conversation is about, like, okay, listen, like, we need to turn and look our fear in the face and meet it and rise above it.
Yeah, it just makes me want to add that we, you know, I think a thing that comes into people's minds or men's minds or partners' minds is like, I hear what you're saying and I get what you're saying, but the stakes are just too high,
yeah,
for me to take that risk. But the important thing that we need to really emphasize and not forget about is, what about the risk you take by intervening, by going with blindly following the standard medical model? What about the risk of ending up with a traumatized mother and a traumatized partner? And instead of starting your life off as a new family with this, like, beautiful, bonding, empowering, powerful, healthy experience, and you're starting it off in huge and unnecessary trauma. Mm-hmm. We need to start seeing that as a real risk too.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to wrap up quick here, cause we're running out of time, but I want people to know, first of all, where they should look to follow you and where they can get a hold of you. If they like, I want Jessica to be my, are you a midwife or
a doula?
Yeah. You're a doula. Yeah. I want Jessica to be my doula. Or I want one of Jessica's midwives that she knows, or, and like, what books should people read? What documentaries should people watch? How can people learn more?
Well, and her website is a really good resource. Like, your website is one of the most trafficked websites for statistical information and real education about birth. And I think that people could just use that resource as well for informing themselves.
What is it?
My website is birthtakesavillage.com, and it has a whole free educational article website that's broken down by category. There's articles on there on place of birth, so safety of home births. It references a lot of the statistics that we've talked about today. There's articles on there on how to be a good support person during birth, how to prepare yourself for birth. So there's all kind of free information in that regard on my website. I also have a Facebook page and an Instagram page where I share a lot of free information and educational information. So my Facebook page is Birth Takes a Village and my Instagram is Jessica Austin Childbirth.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. Shalina, do you have anything to say in wrapping up?
Just that we'll put a bunch of these resources in the notes so like we can reference that. But the other thing that I just wanted to mention too was that you locally here, you run, it's Birth, We Birth at Home?
Yeah, the We Birth at Home prenatal classes, which are prenatal classes for pregnant people and their partners as they're preparing for birth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you have plans to take that online?
Well, I'm on a little bit of a mini work, sort of half trying to be on work leave myself because I'm pregnant and having a baby of my own very soon. That's always kind of in the, it's been on my to-do list to put it online for a very long time, but I don't know how quickly I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah. So if you're local, I've had the pleasure of sitting in on a few of your, I've sat in on your doula training and on your prenatal training as well. And it's, in my opinion, the one and only training to go to. So definitely worth it. Even if you're about an hour drive, it'd be worth it. And there's people who do make that drive to come and learn from you. So you could check those out as well.
Fantastic, ladies. Thanks so much for this enlightening conversation for so many, I'm sure. Thank you for taking the time to come in and talk with us. And let's spread this podcast episode all over the universe. Everybody needs to hear this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.